You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
When you started Blackstone, you were 38 years old. You'd already made wealth being one of the highest ranking managers at Lehman Brothers. What drove you to say, I could do whatever I want for the rest of my life, but I think I'm going to work 100 hours a week instead and also do the rest of what I want for the rest of my life?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't regard it as work. I regard it as an adventure. And memos I get on situations at work, I don't look at them as work. I look at them as short stories. And I get to play a part in the story. I can help write the story.
That's fascinating.
So I don't feel put upon with the normal concept of work. I mean, it's really fascinating. Can you imagine a life where you spend your time learning new things all the time?
Of people listening to this, maybe they've been driving back and forth to the same job for 20 years, you know, with a simmering frustration that they never pursue their dreams. How does someone find their dream? All right, so we've got an extremely impressive guy in the studio, Steve Schwarzman, chairman, CEO, co-founder of Blackstone, which is the biggest, I'll call it a private equity fund, but it's really the biggest money. It's basically the most influential and one of the biggest managers of money on the planet. You have $474 billion under assets. That's a lot of money, almost half $1 trillion. You're like five countries all rolled up into one. You own half the world practically. Like, what are some of the companies you own or own parts of?
Well, we used to own Hilton.
We took that public.
We own a company that's called Refinitiv, but was Thomson Reuters. So we've just sold that. We bought it for $20 billion. We sold it to the London Stock Exchange. And assuming that goes through antitrust in Europe, we'll be the largest shareholders in the London Stock Exchange. We're the largest owners of real estate in the world. Sort of a funny thing to say, but because we started—
Both homes and commercial properties, your Innovation Homes was brilliant.
Right. So it's all kinds of real estate all around the world, as well as companies. We're the largest investors in hedge funds in the world, and we're one of the largest extenders of credit and into leverage situations.
So let's— can I ask you about that for a second?
Sure.
And this is more for the audience just to understand. Like, typically when we think of debt, the first reaction is, oof, debt. And the second reaction might be, well, the government has a lot of debt. And then the third reaction might be, well, okay, debt, because when I buy my house, I borrow from the bank.
Right.
And everybody thinks that's normal, and every other instance of debt is not normal. But when I describe what you do to people, it makes so much more sense than a bank lending a homeowner money for debt. Even though that makes sense too, that's usually a safe bet for a bank. What you do is like that, except the thing that you're buying, a company, actually gives you back cash in return as opposed to a home that someone lives in.
Right. Yeah, well, what we do is in the private equity part of our business, we buy companies, and we have about 500,000 people who work at our companies, and apparently, you know, that's the second largest employer in the country after Walmart. So we own probably as many as 200 companies. But before we buy one, we have to have a plan to make it better, because we don't make any money if it doesn't get better, because we've paid to buy it, and usually we paid a high price to buy something. So there's always a plan to have it grow faster and make more profits. When a company grows faster, it needs more investment, and it also needs to hire more people. And so what happens with what we do is we improve it. Our companies tend to grow about 50% faster than the average companies. We enhance—
Well, why do you think that is?
Oh, I know why that is, because we study businesses before we buy them. It's not like buying a stock on a stock exchange. We get all of the data on the company. We can meet with the management, and sometimes the management has ways of improving the company they won't do, because if you're a public company, sometimes that slows down your growth and your stock goes down. But it enables the company to grow a lot faster further out in the future. And sometimes they don't make those investments. And with us, if the company is private, we will make those investments cheerfully. We won't care so much what the profits are in the short term. And you know, we recruit people who are to manage the company who are sometimes better than the people who are there. And it's all geared to growing fast, creating a better organization, hiring more people, and we enhance the return by putting some debt on the company. So it's interesting. You would think that was risky. What happened through the global financial crisis is this style of investing basically had no more bad outcomes than the average company that didn't have that amount of debt on it. It was quite interesting. You know, one way you protect the company when you do that is you have the maturities very, very far out. So it's like a mortgage where you don't pay down principal. And you know, almost anybody can make their interest payments. Not everybody. If you have excess and bad regulation during the crisis, some people couldn't. But for almost my entire life, people don't default on their homes. That was just a very unusual time in history. So we shock test every business we buy, and we look at the worst downturns, like the global financial crisis, and we'll never put more debt on a company than you could easily service during the financial crisis. So as a result of these types of things, our profits from those types of activities are about double the profits of an investor in the stock market in an index. So if you make double the profit, you become very popular from the people who give you money. So who gives us money? Well, we get money from large pension funds. About a third of it is from, you know, public pension funds. It's firemen, policemen, government workers, teachers, and we have a huge share of that business. So when we make more money than the average, they get the benefit. So the people who are getting the benefits are regular people for their retirement. They don't get to see it because somebody's choosing those investments for them. But if their pension funds aren't funded and their future secure, then something really bad, you know, will happen to their lives. So we're contributing to that. We're contributing, you know, to employment. We've created about 100,000 jobs, and it's a really positive sums game, and it's a great thing to be doing, because there are winners everywhere.
Right. So the business you buy wins because it grows. The potential employees who are future hired by the business benefit. The community where that business is benefits. Your investors, which trickle down to the, you know, teachers in the California Teachers Fund, right, or whatever, they benefit. But you said many things actually that were interesting that I want to unpack a little. First is this implication that where does your money come from? My guess is when you start a new fund or raise new business, your best new customers are your old customers.
That's absolutely right. So you start a business, no matter who starts, whatever it is, whether it's a green grocer, you got to have some customers. And if they talk to their friends, if you have, you know, sort of good melons, you'll get more business. And ours is the same. And that's why it's important that everything we do has to be very successful. Because to a certain degree, it's a referral business. We help that by going out on and calling on those new potential investors. But they're always interested in how did things work. And so that's why we are very risk averse as a company, as a firm, because you never want to have anybody, excuse me, give a bad recommendation.
Right. And so, I mean, you mentioned throughout the book and one of your 25 rules for life, which, by the way, if you read anything, if you read anything in any book, read that one chapter and hang it up on your wall, which is what I'm going to do. And I'm not saying this, sorry if that sounds obsequious. It's true. These statements are really powerful and we'll talk about them later. But I want to also unpack a couple of things about your description of what you do. You because these companies are not public stocks that you mostly invest in almost 100% of the time, you don't have to worry about quarter by quarter, oh my gosh, if I say the wrong word, the stock's going to fall 20%, everyone's going to hate me, the board's going to fire me, I'm going to feel like a failure. You could, as you mentioned to the Chinese premier, you're planting seeds and watching them, you have time to watch them grow. And I think that's what separates out a private fund by investing in private businesses from like a mutual fund or an investor who invests in stocks and is like constantly refreshing Yahoo Finance. There's nothing for you to refresh. You have to actually go into the guts of the business and see, is this working in reality, not just a stock going up and down?
Yeah, you've got it. Our business is to make these things work. And you know, that's where the extra return, if you will, comes from. And we're very patient. You know, I don't care whether something could be done in 3 years or 5 years, as long as it's done. And, you know, we took a company like Hilton, and I think we got close to doubling its number of rooms. Hilton's now got an award of best place to work in the United States. And when we took that company over, that wasn't the case. And it was the most profitable, investment ever made in the private equity business, not by us, by anybody. I think we made somewhere between $12 and $14 billion of profit. But the way you do that isn't by setting out to make profit. You have to make something better.
Right. You can't just love hotels and then want to buy Hilton, because right. that might be, you're not using any kind of criteria for right. what makes this a good investment.
Right. So we figured out how to make that a much better company, and that happened.
But it's not just that you made it a better company. When you were breaking down the deal in the book, and by the way, you don't do a lot of deal breaking down. This book is not in the weeds. It's very interesting to see the arc of your success and how you did it and what you've learned. But Hilton is a great example of you being what you described as risk averse. Like, you analyze, because you get all the information, you analyze first, how do we avoid losing money? And what you identified, it looked like to me, out of their, I don't know how many thousands of hotels they have, but you identified six or seven of the most premier hotels, including the Waldorf Astoria, and said, oh, if I just have these seven hotels and sell them or do something with them, that's half the value of the deal. And then I've got another 10,000 hotels to work with.
Yeah, well, we try and find some sensible way to win. That's ethical and reduces risk or gives us more money to grow faster within the company somewhere else. It's actually a lot of fun.
So in that case, though, you know, finding an opportunity like that where a small piece of the company can almost pay for the entire deal, that would seem to be relatively rare. You have to find special situations. Like in this case, the CEO, he was getting older, he wanted to retire. You were friends, he wanted to sell the business, he sold to you. Why didn't he just take those seven hotels, sell them, have the stock price go much higher, and then sell?
Well, it's interesting. There is a certain lethargy that sometimes sets in. There's sometimes a different incentive structure. And sometimes when you do things that are different, there's risk, and it might not work out so well. So not necessarily in this case, but more generally, people often are risk averse. We think we are too, but we're so used to doing things. We have a really great idea of how they're gonna turn out, or else we don't go forward. Some people, when they're not sure, don't move. And so that creates sort of, sometimes there's fresh eyes on a situation that allow you to see things that maybe somebody else doesn't have that experience.
It seems like perception is just as much part of business as reality. And that plays a role in a lot of your decisions. And I want to dive into that a little further. But in this one case, let's take Hilton. Maybe Hilton was afraid to sell the Waldorf Astoria because that was such a gem for Conrad Hilton, you know, decades ago. And the CEO of Hilton maybe just didn't want to cloud public perception of his company by selling off their prized jewel. But when you took it private, you don't need to think about that.
Right. And you try and think about things that will help the business and are sensible. And you try to just look at things objectively. And it's very hard to be objective, if you were raised at Hilton doing something like selling the Waldorf. It would be like
a sin.
I was going to say apostasy. It wouldn't get, sort of a normal kind of a hearing.
Right, so I'm not saying he made a bad decision. He made the decision maybe even best for his stock price, which was his eventual price he sold the company to you. So he was aware he could sell it, but he didn't want to deal with the short-term ramifications of everyone being disappointed.
Well, they got a very good price at the time selling it to us. Nobody else would have paid that price, but nobody else would have looked at the business and recognized, that's not quite true, no one else, there were one or two people in the world would have, that that, you know, we could expand it so much faster because they had stopped expanding internationally, and the company had a great name, huge brand name recognition, but they hadn't opened a new hotel outside the United States for, I think it was either 20 years or 25 years.
And why do you think?
Because they split the company in half, and the foreign part was a separate company controlled by other people. It had its own public listing in London, and for some reason, they never wanted to expand. And they, right before we bought the whole thing, they put that foreign business back together, and we looked at it and said, geez, there's so much international growth. We could just open a huge number of hotels that people wanted, and we even could get them to put up the money, and we could manage them. So we were making, you know, like huge rate of return on those, required no capital, and we got paid most of the profits. So this is a good structure to use. It completely reinvigorated the brand. And, you know, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about Hilton, this one was sort of easy.
But it's a good example of A, what you do, how you reduce risk, how you then take a company and expand it. So it's two things. One is on the reducing risk, you could potentially sell or value correctly the properties you have. And then the second is, where can we expand that for whatever reason, doesn't matter what, the company was not expanding. And in those two ways, you bring up the value. Just like when a house doubles in value, a homeowner makes maybe 5 to 10 times his money because they're using leverage, that enhances your returns. What would you say, you know, I forgot to mention two things in the intro. One is you're an incredibly successful investor. What would you say is the average return, if you can figure it out, of your funds, your main fund, whatever?
Yeah, our funds in the high performance area like I'm talking about, you know, would earn after fees somewhere around 17% every year.
Right, which is phenomenal, as everybody knows. Yeah. And you know, the other thing I forgot to mention is how much you've been involved over the past several decades, particularly in the past 2 decades, in behind-the-scenes public policy. Like in the financial crisis, you were on the phone with Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, and even Barack Obama, in terms of how they kind of both solve the financial crisis and then have a soft landing from a public perception point of view of how to deal with issues like the bailout and so on. And then even with you know, President Trump, you've been involved in giving advice. You also give a lot to charity. I want to discuss some of that. But reeling it back to the beginning, your dad had a store, and you were always pushing him, "Dad, why don't you expand? It would be so easy." And he's like, "Oh, I'm fine. This is good. I have a good life. Are you complaining?" And he was right too. But what do you think gives you this, when you started Blackstone, you were 38 years old, you'd already made wealth as being one of the highest ranking managers at Lehman Brothers. What drove you to say, I could do whatever I want for the rest of my life, but I think I'm going to work 100 hours a week instead and also do the rest what I want for the rest of my life?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't regard it as work. I regard it as an adventure. You know, memos I get on situations at work, I don't look at them as work. I look at them as short stories. And I get to play a part in the story. I can help write the story.
That's fascinating.
So I don't feel put upon with the normal concept of work. I mean, it's really fascinating. Can you imagine a life where you spend your time learning new things all the time? And you can ask anybody who's involved with them who will know more than yourself, you know, about how does this work? What can we learn here? And, you know, we formed an amazing team of people at Blackstone. And everybody is so smart. I am the least smart person at the firm.
Doubt it. People say that, but go ahead.
No. I can almost prove it. And you know, we hire all these Magnas and Sumas And, you know, I wasn't magna summa or even cum laude when I graduated. And so the opportunity to be with people who are smart, prepared, doing new things all over the world, in different asset classes. And so you learn constantly about everything, and then you interweave, you know, the politics that needs to happen in all these different places, so you understand what's going on. This is so fascinating that, you know, it's addictive. And, you know, forget that the decisions could be scary, but you get used to, you know, sort of committing huge amounts of capital. Actually, we have, you know, since you read that draft of the book, we now have $545 billion instead of $480 billion. So we got over your, you know, sort of half a trillion. you know, half a trillion mark. These are billions we have, not you know, hundreds of millions. So I find all of these things fascinating. Plus, they're great tests of your ability to do well. In other words, make pretend you're a basketball player. Sometimes you get paid a lot of money to play basketball. Sometimes you just like going on a court. You like playing basketball. And you'll do it for big money. You'll do it for no money. You just like to play because you like the feeling of trying to, you know, get around somebody who's guarding you, put the ball up and just have it go in the basket, watch the arc, and have that sound when it goes through the net. Whoosh. It's really fun. And so I look at the things I do very much like that. Every person I meet is an adventure. They're all different.
I guess when you get, I mean, thinking about it in terms of storytelling, when you get, let's say, a deal memo for the first time, like, oh, Steve, here's an opportunity, it is almost like the classic arc of the hero. You're getting an opportunity to go from your ordinary world to the extraordinary world where you own this company, and now you're confronted with a set of problems. You meet new people to help those problems. The problems get bigger and bigger until the final problem, which is creating and exiting value out of the company, and then you return to use your new knowledge for the next story.
Yeah, I hadn't looked at, you know, this as a heroic enterprise, but you know, that is what it is. And as you were speaking, I realize I have a huge number of them going on simultaneously, and so you can always like switch channels, switch the channel in your mind. And as soon as you switch, it's like a real channel switch, right? You get a different program. How interesting is that?
Right.
No commercials.
So now you can say this, not at the end of your career, obviously, but in hindsight, since the 80s when you started the firm, when you were first starting, it was brutal. You had to raise money. You were going to meetings, like you described the meeting with Delta in Atlanta, where they were like, hey, nice to see you. We're not going to invest, but nice to meet you. And you and Pete Peterson had to fly over there and then fly back, and he threatened to kill you if you ever do that to him again. It wasn't pleasant in the beginning. And then you had, people learn lessons often from hard experiences. You had that initial, perhaps the worst investment you made, which was Edgecombe. These are brutal experiences that nobody wants to go through.
Yeah, I don't blame them. These are horrible experiences. And one of the things that's quite popular now is becoming an entrepreneur, because people have some vision that you announce you're an entrepreneur and somehow, you know, like in, 6 months, you're magically enormously successful and affluent, and you take a victory lap. That's not the way it works.
Right.
That's the way it works every once in a God knows how many. But real people, that's not how it works.
Like in that beginning time, did you ever feel like saying, ugh, this is not worth it. I don't want people to think I'm a failure. I'll just try the next thing when it comes along.
Well, I knew what we were headed towards was a good thing, But getting there was so difficult. And one of the things, one of the lessons in the book is you have to be prepared for enormous psychic pain to become successful.
How do you deal with that?
It's like being an athlete in training. I mean, I was a track athlete, and you train before the meets, and the way you train is you overtrain. So you'll run more than you run in a meet. You'll run with more frequency, and if you're going to run one race in practice, you run three. And you won't just run the same distance. Sometimes you'll run double or triple or quadruple the distance. So you basically train yourself to one, have more stamina than you'll need when you perform. But also, the idea of going through, in effect, they describe that for marathons, the wall of pain. You just keep going. And you have to be prepared for that loneliness, for the isolation, for the psychic pain, because the world doesn't fall into line because you want to do something. If you're selling anything new, somebody's already using something old, they like it, more or less. So getting people to change, because people don't often like changing. We say we do, but they actually like familiar things for the most part. Not 100%, but for the most part. So if your proposition is you've got something new, you're making somebody change, you're already at a disadvantage. And when you start, you are delusional. You think because you're doing it, it's great. Everybody should hop on board. And when they don't, you better quickly figure out that to get there, maybe you need to do it a little different way. But what you have to have is enormous tenacity. And you never can give up.
And it seems like self-forgiveness as well. Because let's say, I mean, along the way you did make some bad decisions. Later on, there were some decisions you made that could have turned out enormously bad. It seems like to have that tenacity, you have to also be able to forgive yourself to basically move on. Were you able to do that in critical points?
I don't look at that in a religious context of forgiveness. I look at it as learning. Mm-hmm. So if you do something that didn't work out the way you say, you know, that's retrospectively, that's a great moment. Because we don't learn from our successes. We just continue to do them. But when you really mess something up, you know, most people try and make pretend it didn't happen or forget about it. I never forget about it. And the reason is there are lessons to be learned. What did I miss? What did we miss? What's wrong with our process that allowed us to miss something that we should have seen? Let's fix it. So you have to look at every situation when it doesn't work the way you thought and say, what's wrong with my paradigm, my thought paradigm or my process or our people or, sort of what did we miss in the world? Where was the inappropriate emphasis we placed on something so we can fix it for the future? So in a way, you never forgive yourself, but you learn. And that's why when you get older, actually, hard to imagine, life is more fun than when you're younger. I always thought I was at maximum, sort of fun, probably at 34. That's about when I was the smartest, I believed.
4 years before you started this company?
Yeah. I mean, 34-year-olds are always totally self-confident and, I was, and by the time I logged in another 10 to 15 years, I realized, oh my God, how could I have thought that? Look at the mistakes I've made, and we fixed those up. So now we're at the point, our business is 34 years old, and I'm actually older than that, I've profited by learning things, and there's still weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Thank you. At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Well, let me ask you this. Like you underline the importance of tenacity, but when should someone give up on a business or a dream or a project?
So the most important thing is to have the right dream. Achieving it is a mechanic. Having the right thing you're pursuing is really, that's really somewhere around 70% of the whole thing.
Of people listening to this, maybe they've been driving back and forth to the same job for 20 years, you know, with a simmering frustration that they never pursue their dreams. How does someone find their dream?
Well, first you have to think about what a dream would be. You know, you can have a dream right where you are. And, you know, whatever you're doing or your organization's doing, nonprofit or profit, and you go, geez, I wonder if we could do this a lot better. And what do I think we should do differently to achieve something that's better than where we are now? So, you know, everyone can do that. You don't have to leave. And you go to, you know, people senior to you, or if you're in charge, you know, you convene a group of people to test your idea and say, we're doing X today, but geez, if we set a different objective and took our people or some percentage of them and pursued this other dream in addition to what we're doing, wouldn't this be more interesting? Wouldn't we do better?
So that's interesting, though, which is, A, finding the dream that you're excited about, but also part of what you've kind of like collapsed into the concept of dream is, what's your vision of doing it differently? That seems to be just as much a part of the dream as anything else.
Well, sometimes, you know, it overlaps with the dream, but sometimes, you know, I mean, I'll give you an example. In the financial recession in 1990-92, all of a sudden, you know, real estate really collapsed. The government basically took over bankrupt savings and loans. There were no real estate transactions that occurred. The system was frozen, and somebody brought us an opportunity. And so I didn't know anything about it. Real estate, I owned a co-op in New York. That was it. And this was a bunch of garden apartments in Little Rock, Arkansas, and East Texas. Neither location I had ever been to. And so, you know, there was very little competition for these. It was the second auction that the government had. I think there were two bidders. We were one. And I priced it in a way that I thought would be very advantageous, because there was virtually almost total illiquidity in the United States. And we won the deal, and we got a 16% yield on the deal.
Because they were rental properties.
There were rental properties that we set up, and the properties were 20% vacant. And so I figured, when, you know, just to start out, if we had 16% with no leverage and I borrowed some money like a mortgage on a house, then I'd make 23% a year forever, more or less. Pretty good. And then when the economy would recover, then that 23% would go up to around 45% if we filled up those vacant units. So I said, geez, 45% forever. This is like really good stuff. And then I realized that if the economy continued to improve, you could then increase the rent. And so I figured I was buying some units well below what they cost to make, and I could end up making 55% a year.
Not even accounting the fact that the value of the properties are going up.
Yeah, leave that aside. This is just on cash flow. And so I ended up being wrong. We made 64%. But who would know?
Steve, why do you make such mistakes? I can't. Why do people tolerate you?
Well, we try. So, but the reason I told the story is about dreams. So we bought this, and I said to the person who brought the deal to us, I said, how much more real estate is there like this in the United States that could be bought? And he said, a whole country full. And I sat there and I said, we should buy everything that we can, because this is such a moment you can't miss. So then the problem became, you know, can we get people who are expert at doing that? Could we raise huge amounts of money to do that? And would things recover slow enough so that we had the time to put those things in place? But the dream was owning as much as you could, because you couldn't miss.
Right. So the dream is not just, oh, I want to buy some properties I can rent out. The dream was, I want to buy properties because A, no one else is here, and you have as one of your rules for work and life, go where no one else is. But often that implies a lot of risk, but you were able to B, take out the risk, and C, that with any kind of normal historical growth, this becomes a huge opportunity. And even without growth, it's an opportunity.
Yeah. And so...
And then you expanded the vision to say, let's own the planet.
Yes. And, you know, and that's a little hyperbolic, but still...
Thank you.
That was the basic thrust of it. And now we're the largest owner of real estate in the world.
But I want to add to that, because there's the other example right after the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, professionals weren't buying individual, you know, homeowner, residential real estate for a variety of reasons. That market had collapsed. Banks were still not lending. And you went in, and even though you're this $100 billion fund at the time, you start off buying a $100,000 property. So it seems like another way of entering into a dream is to experiment, because you're not going to buy a $10 billion property as your first foray into a dream. You're going to buy one hundredth of 1% of what you could do. You're going to experiment with this opportunity.
Well, that's actually not true. I would have bought $10 billion if I could have, but there was nothing for sale because all these houses are individually owned. And so what happened is the government made a huge mistake in regulation, which is, you know, I don't know why people don't look at the financial crisis and say, it couldn't have just been these stupid banks. There must have been somebody regulating them. Okay, so they were completely incorrectly regulated. So what happened with housing is they let, before the collapse, they had very small down payments. So you could put up 4% equity and borrow 25 times your money and you had a house.
Right, and now, just as an example, you have to put down 20 or 30%.
Right, so what happened after this crisis? So as prices were skyrocketing, what the regulators should have done is increase the down payments to 20% or 25%, because it would have made it very difficult for people to buy houses. And it would have slowed down the big acceleration in values, and you would have had a normal housing cycle. But what the government did was stoked up the cycle. It's like they threw kerosene on it, because you had to put up almost nothing. So after everything collapsed, what did they do? They did the opposite. When houses collapsed 40%, they said, geez, why don't you put up 25% equity? Well, nobody had 25% equity when things were great. Who's going to have 25% equity to put up for a house? When the stock market collapsed, there's high unemployment, the economy was dead. The answer, nobody. So the government stopped the recovery. It's hard to imagine people do this, but it's very easy to see. I just described it to you.
And I could understand, perception's complicated, right? So they they want to say, okay, well, we made mistakes in the past. We're not going to make that mistake again. It seems to the public like they're doing the right thing, even if it's financially the wrong thing.
It's catastrophically wrong, because what you want to do is make housing available for people. That's when you want little equity, and you want to restart the economy. You want to give people a chance to have new homes and new construction, and they'll have new jobs. So what they did is they did the exact reverse as regulators. So for us, we looked at that and said, oh my goodness, you know, people aren't going to be able to buy houses. People need houses. Houses are being repossessed. And we never repossessed a house. They were just being sold at auction. So we said, why don't we buy houses and we'll put money in them. We'll fix them up, because a lot of these houses were half abandoned. We'll fix them up. We can provide jobs for the construction people, and we'll rent them.
Right, so you became, rather than taking advantage of a situation, which is, again, public perception has two sides, you were the buyer of last resort. You
yes.
set the floor, and that's when housing actually did start to rise. Housing prices rise once there was a buyer.
Right, so we sort of knew when the bottom was, because nobody was buying anything, and the government was choking credit off. And so all you had to do was buy them, if you had a lot of money, which we do, and fix them and let regular people rent them. And they could be in a good school district. And what was wrong with that?
Right. So you know, for people listening—
That was the dream.
Right. And each time you sort of go to the place least crowded where everybody's running from there, you're walking in— and you're finding what you could do differently. You're finding where the opportunity is that people are missing. So you're risk averse. But if I'm sitting at home thinking, well, how can I go to the place least crowded? How do I start exercising that muscle of finding out where there's a gap between reality and perception? Steve seems really good at it. How do I get good at that muscle?
Well, it's interesting. Usually that happens with information. It happens with your familiarity with the world you're engaged with. And if you look around, not everybody sees everything that they think is perfect. That's not the way most people encounter the world. There's always something that can be done better or improved, or some other things that you think about that you could be good at. What do you like in life? What do you think you could do that you haven't tried, but it's in your comfort zone? You know, it's always good to be doing something with somebody you know who knows something. The idea of just sailing out, you know, into the Atlantic Ocean, hoping you were going to find America, not many people would do that, like Christopher Columbus, right? But if you have somebody who's already made it to the New World, they know how to navigate, you can get on that ship, and your chance of getting there is better.
Right. You describe with the savings and loans crisis, you didn't know anything about real estate, but you had someone on board who knew an enormous amount. And
right.
Larry Fink, right, knew an enormous amount. And a lot of it, too, is people don't know people. And you describe in your, I think it's rule number three in your rules of work and life, write to people who you can learn from and try to meet them. Sometimes it's not that easy because they're busy by definition. That's why you want to learn from them. How does the average person meet or learn, get a mentor or virtual mentors, or at least learn from someone who is fascinating to them?
Well, you have to be looking. And these things don't hit you in the face. So if you want to learn about something, one thing I find about Americans, which is much different than a lot of other places in the world, Americans like sharing. They like helping people. There's a part of our personality that's like that. And everybody who's been successful has been helped by somebody. Nobody does this journey alone. That's like some novelist who doesn't understand how the world works, writes that kind of stuff. And real world, that doesn't happen. That lonely person wandering around, discovering gold someplace, You really need the help of other people to support you, to instruct you, to introduce you to other people who might be good for you. So you have to recognize you're going on a journey, and you're looking for guides and people who know more than you or know something different than you. And you know, you talk to them and you learn from them. And if you have some kind of drive or some kind of gift or some kind of curiosity, and you have a modicum of talent, and somebody else sees that in you, they'll help you along. And part of what makes America a special place is that if you've done well as a result of that kind of personal, you know, sort of assistance, then you have an obligation to help somebody else. People aren't islands. That's not the way people want to be. And my experience is, you know, there's always some nasty piece of work who tells you to get lost. But, you know, if you're really sincere and you need some help, and or you're looking for something, or you're looking for information or relationships or something different, if you're communicative and you lay that out, you'd be surprised people respond. Not 100% of the people. Way more people than you'd think. And that sets you off on a journey.
How important is the aspect of when you're reaching out to that person you want to learn from, you bring with you something of value so that they, not that every engagement has to be transactional, not that every time you meet someone has to be transactional, but I'm assuming in many cases where you reached out to someone you were learning from, you also offered something of value.
Well, it's interesting. One thing of value is flattery. You know, people's self-images are always unpredictable to the person who's approaching them. And the fact that you're approaching them sometimes helps them self-validate. The fact that you've thought about that person and there's something you do want to learn from them, there's some piece of advice you want, all you have to do is say, you know, I want to go on a journey. I want to change what I'm doing, or I want to achieve something. You know, you've done a bunch of that. How can you describe to me how you do that? What do you think next steps, you know, should be? And since everybody has a history, everybody, you know, is on a journey. Even if you see them as static, they know they've been on a journey to get where they are. They usually will say, "Oh, that's interesting. What brings you here?"
Right, because you in your last rule of work and life, I'll just read it. It's very interesting to me. You say number 25: everyone has dreams. Do what you can to help others achieve theirs, and that's related to this. It's not that. Again, it's not transactional. It's not charitable. It's somewhere in between, where if you want them to listen to you, if you want them to teach you, you also have to respect their dreams.
Yes. Well, it is interesting that enabling someone to do something is very rewarding. It's empowering. And you don't have to get anything from it other than the joy of affecting somebody else's life and taking away barriers so they can have their dream, they can be self-actualized. You've changed a life, and it doesn't even cost anything. It just takes a little bit of time. And it's interesting, I got an email this morning from a student who had graduated from the Schwarzman Scholars Program, which I started in China to deal with U.S.-China relationships, and assembled a group of people like from the Rhodes for graduate school, and you know, we got 40% Americans and 40% from the rest of the world and 20% Chinese. It's a fascinating, unique program where they meet the leaders of the country and travel around and, you know, work in a you know, in a Chinese ministry or not-for-profit or corporation. And, you know, it's about 140, 150 people a year, you know, truly extraordinary people. So this was one of those who graduated like 2 or 3 years ago and was telling me how her life was going. Because I sent her a happy birthday thing. That's what we do for all of our graduates. I like to send them a little happy birthday thing
on the
internet. Yeah, just, you know, keep in touch. And she was saying, geez, you know, as a result of you providing the following base, look at the remarkable things that I'm doing now. This happened to be a remarkable person. And I said, I just wanted to thank you for that. And I have a lot of things I do in a day, but sort of read that one and I went, how wonderful that we were able to really change this person's life by providing opportunity, guidance, background, and she will end up doing the same. And it's not like a do-gooders society. It's just what you do as a human to help other people.
So it's interesting the way you describe that and the joy you get, this feeling of I helped and that feels good. And you describe that almost that same feeling. I can imagine it's almost that same feeling during the financial crisis. Hank Paulson's undersecretary or assistant calls you and says, hey, Hank just wants you to know, thanks for the guidance you gave him. And your initial thought was, I helped, and you felt good. Compare the two feelings, this morning's and that one.
It's the same thing. The financial crisis is different, right? You're protecting the system. You're protecting everyone's way of life. If the government, Hank and Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner hadn't done the right things, and at that time, President Bush and the Congress, if they hadn't done the right things, we would have had a catastrophic collapse, and we weren't going to be getting out of that one. And
what would have happened, by the way? I'm always curious about that.
Well, I think you would have had, you know, like a collapse of the financial system.
Say everyone goes to the ATM, there's no money there. What do people do the next day?
Well, the bank may not be there. So the government would have taken over banks. You would have had, sort of markets all collapse. You would have had unemployment at unimaginable levels. You would have had negative economic growth for quite some time. And you would have had to restart your economy. It actually wouldn't have been imaginable if this thing just all dropped and we couldn't tape together financial institutions as to what happened to Lehman. I mean, it just like disappeared. It stopped functioning. Everybody was unemployed. So this was a very, very shockingly dangerous situation where most people wouldn't have understood that. But if you were raised as part of that part of the economy, you would know that. So trying to help people, because we're all like people. I mean, nobody ever been through this and it was alive.
Right.
So, you know, people in Hank's position and the other few people that I mentioned, they had to get it right. So if you could help them think about things, you know, then it's like your obligation, you know, to help.
I like how your wife forced you to call Hank with advice. She was like, call him.
I never would have called. I figured he just knew everything. Huh. So, you know.
That's an interesting thing, that your assumption, you never assume everybody knows everything. Anybody knows everything.
But I knew that what was going on was so profound that he would know the basic elements, which he did. I've talked to him subsequently a bunch, and he said, look, the things you were telling me, they were on our agenda, right? We knew all these ideas you were telling us, but they said, you gave us an insight, not just on those things, but on the timing.
Do you think a financial crisis like that could happen again? I mean, obviously it can, theoretically, but do you think we've insulated ourselves?
Well, in the short term, we've insulated ourselves quite well. In the United States, we have really conservative financial institutions now, and they've got loads and loads of capital, probably three to four times what they had in the crisis. Lending standards are much more conservative, and so we fought that war. We won it. But what happens in subsequent generations, people forget the lessons of that war, and that's why you have wars repeatedly in history. Somebody thinks they can win them. The risk we have, and this may be too technical for your audience, but the same way the regulators messed up the housing recovery by doing just the opposite, as part of the the Dodd-Frank reforms, they restricted very substantially the ability of the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank, to rescue the system. This was perhaps the most unwise set of laws that I've seen.
The Dodd-Frank laws, or
this part of the Dodd-Frank law, because they said, well, the Federal Reserve bailed out the system. We never want that to happen again. The problem, that's like saying, oh, that doctor saved that patient. We never want that doctor to treat another patient.
And it's funny because I don't think many people also realize the remedy was sort of outlined in Bernanke's PhD thesis from way back about how to solve the Great Depression. And he had a chance to actually put it into action, and it worked.
But the amazing thing is, in terms of bailing out the banking system, it is actually sort of a misnomer, right? You gave them money and bought, in effect, stock in their company. And when they recovered, they gave you the money back with a profit. I don't know of a government program that's ever gotten money back with a profit. Government spends the money, it goes away. Here they made a profit, and it's got a bad name. So the idea that we've restricted the central bank from doing certain types of things to make sure that the financial system in a crisis is safe and sound is, it's basically, I hate to say something like this because somebody might quote me, it's malpractice.
Well, what do you think now with, we've been deregulated, Dodd-Frank, we're chipping away at it, and the government has deregulated a lot of local, regional banks. Do you think that should spread to the more national banks? Like, do you think there's too much now? It's too conservative?
I don't know that it's too conservative. I think our system, as I said, is very well capitalized and well regulated at this point. What I was talking about was infrastructure that they've changed, because you always get an overreaction when you have a collapse. You get people say we need a lot of regulation, and you do need more. The question is every piece of what you do right? And the answer typically is, because people are working in a hurry and they don't have perspective and they want to get something done, there's some stuff that people put into things that is like will get you an opposite outcome, and some things they're done that are right and sound. And we need to fix the parts of this that don't work, because we never want to expose the system, in a way where doctors can't practice to save patients.
So, I want to go another 5,000 feet higher for a second, and just in terms of a thread I noticed throughout the book about your decision-making. Whenever you're confronted with a big deal, a big decision, you find your way to not squeeze out every dime, which you contrast yourself with. You're not looking for short-term, let's win every aspect of this negotiation. You find a way, though, bigger picture, bigger perception, to get something more in every case. And I'm thinking specifically of a non-financial decision. When you were offered the chairmanship of the Kennedy Center, any human being would just say, yes, I'd be honored to. But you were like, yes, but I'm only going to do it if Carolyn Kennedy gets back involved. So it's, and we could talk about that specific situation, but it seems like in every situation, you look for what is missing here that is open, that I can get bigger in this decision.
Well, I like to be successful just like everybody else. So I like easy successes, right? So why make them hard? They're hard enough anyhow. Mm. So I always like to figure out, what does it take? And I guess that's why it's the name of the book. What does it take to make this situation into a winner? And in the Kennedy Center thing, because we had a big TV show and gave out the Kennedy Center Honors Awards every year to like five remarkable humans. I had a lot of fun with that. That to make that show better and to unite the community in Washington, and it was called the Kennedy Center, and the way it worked is, you know, Ted Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, took care of that, and Carolyn took care of the Kennedy Library up outside of Boston. And, you know, I figured if we could get the whole family behind the Kennedy Center and give it more of a shot in the arm and try and change perception a little bit and make it less Washington and more, you know, sort of, you know, New York, Boston, whatever. Carolyn was a symbol of the family, and you know, she didn't want to do it really because she had her own responsibilities. They divided that, and I said that's the killer app for this program. It's a symbol, unites the country, tells a story, makes everyone feel better. And so that's why I said that's got to happen.
So it's almost like the lesson there is, don't go for the easy yes and then try for change. Get the change first so that the yes becomes easier.
Right. You have to have, as I say, you need a vision of what you want because you know that vision, if realized, will make things successful, make them work, make them wonderful. And so you have to have that really before you start. And you have to assemble those pieces. Because once those pieces are there, you'll figure out how to shuffle those pieces. But if the pieces aren't there, there's nothing to shuffle.
Right? And you also have to have confidence to say no. So if someone's offered a job, typically they're like, oh, they want me? This is great. You have to always be able to say no and find that hidden perceptual thing that no one's asking for.
Well, you also, I mean, I've been offered a number of really interesting things that I didn't think I was qualified for. And, you know, some of them, I was offered to be the head of a major securities firm at 34, I think. And, I mean, that was ridiculous. So I could have had the prestige of taking that job, and I would have failed. Why? Not because I'm a dummy. I just had no idea what I was doing at that age. You know, I couldn't handle that. And, you know, the people asking me said, oh, you're really terrific. You can handle that. I said, no, I can't handle that. I don't have the relevant experience. I need to be, you know, at least 10 years older to have those, you know, aggregate experiences where I've learned things. I, you know, I'm not qualified. They said, well, please be the head of this. And I said, I'm not qualified. I'm turning this down. So it's not getting something. It's knowing you can really do it and be, you know, hugely successful. And we all know our capabilities. And nobody wants to be in a situation they're not qualified for.
But I guess that's linked to setting up a situation where you could say yes, knowing you've got the cards you need to succeed. Like if you, like maybe you could have said yes in that situation if they said, look, we're going to keep on, you know, this board of advisors, they don't want to be CEO, but they're great. They'll all be in charge of their divisions.
I always like to say, what's the best this can be? What's it going to look like? And then you just assemble the pieces. If you start out just sort of stumbling around in the dark, it's really hard to find the bathroom. If you know where it is, or you left on that little mirror light, you know, where you put makeup, you'll always find the bathroom. So it's that simple.
That's a good quote. I'm going to remember that one. Another thing I noticed as a thread throughout the book is there's this concept that when two people talk to each other, and this is really important in the investment business, but in any business, that they're telling each other the truth. If A talks to B, both sides assume, without any reason to not assume, that both sides are telling the truth. And everybody has a certain threshold by which, after that threshold, they'll start to be suspicious. Below that threshold, they'll just assume the other person's telling the truth. And on average, people have a very high threshold. You seem to have a much lower threshold, where if someone tells you or pitches you a deal, it's not that you're insane and thinking everyone's lying to you. You're not a conspiracy theorist. But, you know, take 2006, 2005, going up into the real estate crisis, I noticed in your stories and in the book, you had a very low threshold for when people would tell you what housing values were, even though the entire country was believing, including very famous hedge fund managers and investors, were believing that housing prices were accurate. You had a very low threshold for believing someone was telling you something accurate.
I always like to be aware, and we teach that at the firm at Blackstone, what's going on in the whole world that's making everybody think what they think. In other words, what they think they believe is legitimate and true. But sometimes, you know, they're just being carried down a very rapid rapids. And what happens is when you're doing that, you know, these rocks are coming at you and so forth, and you have a sense of exhilaration, but you know, the whole world is in rapids, and then you get to the bottom, and then, you know, it's like a quiet pool. And you look at life differently. So in a way, just on a financial basis and in economies and other parts, you know, I found that life is cyclical. Things are cyclical. And you have to know where you are, you know. So when you were just mentioning housing and these people thinking that things could never end, that was a cycle that you could see building. And it was right at the top. So everything they were all saying to each other, they believed to be true, but it wasn't. It was a bubble. And why was it a bubble? There was massive amounts of money, very few restrictions. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry could buy something. And so that lasts for a while, and then it usually collapses. So it's not that, you know, I have a low threshold. I just look at things for what they are. And the people who are telling you something, they mostly believe it, but they may be wrong.
But I guess it's like exercising a muscle to be able to not follow the herd. I mean, the herd behavior bias is strong.
Well, I'm not sure it's so much just a herd. It's looking at everything in a an unemotional context and always asking the question, what's happening here? Why is this person here? And why do they believe what they believe? And what's going on in this whole area that's bringing them here? So for example, I guess it was somewhere around late 2006, within 6 weeks, we got visits from three giant private companies that sold or suppliers to house building. Well, my family's had this company for three generations. We just want to sell it now. Okay. Maybe it's an opportunity. By the time the second person comes in, well, my family's owned this thing for two generations and we want to sell it now. And the third guy's maybe, I bought this company 4 years ago and now I want to sell this company now. And you go, why are they all selling this company? These people must know something. It's like, we've never seen these people before. What's happening? And then you start looking and you see the reason they're selling is they think the whole thing's so overheated. It doesn't matter whether it's three generations old or I just bought it last week. I just want to sell it. Get the hell out of here. Okay? So they believe something that they didn't tell me, of course. And what happens is you look for patterns. And when you see three people in the same little industry all wanting to sell everything they own, that usually tells you you don't know the full story.
So where do you see it? Do you see this happening in any pockets of the economy right now?
Consumer part of the economy is really quite good. It's a fascinating thing. We have this income issue. They call it income inequality, but it's really more income insufficiency. We have like the bottom 40% of the country that isn't making enough income to lead a good life. And that drives our politics to a significant degree. So one of the fixes is you have to get more money to those people. And there are a lot of different ways to do it. But one way it's happening is as the minimum wage starts going up, wages for that group are going up much faster than inflation. And so you've got full employment, pretty much, but wages for the, sort of bottom 25 to 50% are going up much faster than they have for decades. And so that gives us a little bit of repair on the insufficiency problem, but it also gives us a really good consumer economy.
So kind of as a final question, do you mind if I ask you a really dumb question?
There are no dumb questions.
This one might be dumb. A few weeks ago, the president announced he would like to buy Greenland. The Danish government said it's not for sale, but of course, everything has a price. There's a lot of people should research. There's a lot of good reasons why we should get Greenland. But why can't a private equity firm of your size actually, if he could buy a country, why can't you buy a country? Because something like Greenland would be pretty valuable. Told you this was a dumb question.
Well, we're not in the real estate development business.
Yeah, but there's all these rare earth mineral resources, uranium resources, and China's buying them all up.
Well, that would be a very inspired, out-of-the-box kind of idea. I guess I haven't lived long enough to see a country sell itself. Sometimes it'll take money to give influence, but to actually stop being a sovereign, I haven't seen that. So,
yeah, no, but it was interesting just that I never thought about it either until he actually said it.
Yeah, it was really, that was sort of an out-of-body kind of idea. And then if you said, well, think about the fascinating thing about the United States. Sort of, wasn't the United States. There were a bunch of colonies, basically, on the East Coast. And, United States was built through a series of acquisitions, purchases of parts of the United States, Louisiana Purchase being the best one for $4 million of, dollar was worth much more back then, but still world's greatest deal. You bought like, what was it, two-thirds of the western United States on the, past the Mississippi River for $4 million. I don't care what the dollars were worth. And then there were some little fill-in pieces. That was pretty amazing. So I'm not really qualified to comment on buying, you know, another country. It's like an out-of-body type of concept. But you know, having land generally, you know, has proven to be a good thing, because whether there are resources underneath them or other types of things, you know, would be good. But I understand that people just sort of shook their heads, as did I. And then I started thinking about it, and I said, geez, if it doesn't cost much, you know, maybe that could be interesting. But of course, in the real world, one, people don't want to do things like that for political reasons. But secondly, you know, what would a price be? My instinct is not cheap.
Might be worth it, though. So
I leave that one to you.
All right, I'm going to start a fund to buy Greenland, and I'll pitch you for money. Stephen Schwarzman, I want to respect your time. Thank you so much for coming up here. Again, CEO, chairman, co-founder of the largest private equity firm in the planet, Blackstone. So much success and so many lessons in your book. The book's called What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. As you can see, Stephen, I've got the whole thing like bookmarked, but I also just recommend people just check out your 25 rules for work and life. They are so incredibly valuable that, and none of them has to do with investing. They're just good rules about success and finding opportunity and pursuing your dreams. Thanks so much for writing it. Thanks for so much for answering my questions. And come on back again. I could go ask you 5 hours more questions, but I know you're running the world, so I got to let you go.
I got to run. Thanks so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, same here. Thank you.
True or false? Walmart has eye care. True. Stop by Walmart to save and browse top designer frames right where you already shop. And they accept most insurance. Welcome to Easy Eye Care. Welcome to your Walmart.